everybody. This is Mike Klassen from Vancouver Overcast. And today I am reigniting this podcast after a long absence. It's been very busy. I am now 10 months into my term as a Vancouver City Councillor. That took up a lot of my time. But before we go back after this August break, I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to sit down and re-engage a little bit on this platform. And I thought no better person to bring is another fellow new city councillor, somebody who's been on the podcast many times, Daniel Fontaine. Daniel, I'll sort of throw the camera to you and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me back again, Mike. It has been a while, but very glad to be back and be able to talk about my favorite topic of municipal politics.
Indeed. So we have got a lot to talk about here. So maybe we'll just kind of start off by saying, now it's September 2023. We've been in office effectively for about 10 months. I think there's a lot of people who are expecting, you know, big sweeping changes. A lot of these things happen incrementally. What are some of the things that that you hear from people when they ask you about, how are things going at City Hall?
Well, you do get asked that a lot, especially in your first year. I think people are saying, how's it going? And you're feeling like you're making progress, et cetera. And I've had a lot of interactions with the public in the last 10 months. And definitely the topic that they ask is, you know, can things go faster? Is there a way to get things done more quickly? And I think for you and I, although we have had some exposure kind of behind the scenes in politics, but now being on the front of house, it really is, sometimes a point of frustration because, you know, people really want things done really quickly, but you have to get things done in the context of the public service and rules and regulations and bylaws and everything else. So that's something I have heard from the public just around trying to see if we can get more things done quickly.
So on that subject, I think that you're right. There are sort of the big things that people expect, sweeping changes, but there are the small things that you can do. You can actually get an email from somebody and a frustration around a building permit or a frustration around a project that's taking too long, or even just a life safety issue in a community or cleanliness issue, like, you know, some garbage hasn't picked up. I'm surprised at sometimes how responsive we are when we actually do those things. We can flag them up through the halls of power in the city manager's office and down through our corporate leadership team, and we can actually get pretty quick response on things. So I am surprised, not in the sense that I don't think that they can do it, in just that when you communicate to people that they are very responsive and are able to give you a pretty good turnaround. There are some things that take a long time, like, you know, concerns around garbage collection timing and recycling and things like that. That is a continuous theme sometimes. But I think that generally speaking, I am overall pretty impressed. But there are those big issues that take a lot of time and have to work through a lot of people.
Yeah, and I tell people, and that's, again, for me, a little bit of an eye-opener. I hadn't really quite appreciated it, but that, you know, to write to council and actually put those issues down on paper. And I agree with you, Mike. Like, I've sent them over to staff, and it's always really rewarding to see, you know, staff respond. We don't always come to a full agreement on things, or we can't do everything, but for the most part, staff are very responsive. And in many cases, the problem gets resolved. And I tell people, don't be afraid to communicate, put things in writing, let your local council and your mayor know what's going on. And then oftentimes we can be interacting with staff and maybe helping to get that done a little bit faster. So I've been actually quite pleased to see how quickly so many things have been responded to.
So you mentioned email. I have to say that one of the things that I find is if somebody sends me an individual email or even sends it to all of council, there are some issues that will catch my attention. So what I'll do is I will, in those cases, usually respond back to the person who's emailed, and I'll say, I'm not sure if anybody else has got in touch with you, but I'd like to follow this up. Sometimes I'm the only person who responds to an individual concern or complaint. Sometimes others do, and I'm just not aware that they are. So I often go, hey, to the other counselors, hey, I got in touch with this person. I'm following up with them. Have you had any engagement with them? Then there's the other types of email campaigns that I find are much less effective. And these are sort of the bulk email campaigns when you start getting people who are literally filling out a form or just putting their name in and you get a form email. And sometimes you can get hundreds of these emails around different issues. I find those are harder for me to really digest and to read. And honestly, I think when you think about how full that inbox is for a city councilor constantly, my sort of appeal to the public is make more effort to kind of reach out in person. I think sometimes I get handwritten or typed up snail mail, as they used to call it. I do get letters, but I often would tell them, make sure you put an email address in that because I would like to follow up with you. And it's much easier than me having to, you know, get somebody to stamp and put it in an envelope and get back to you that way. But I think that constituency side of our job is something that I really enjoy doing, and I know that you get that kind of real-time feedback from what's going on in the public.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mike. I think pretty much everyone I know that's involved in civic politics, they do it for public service. They're not doing it for their own personal gain, and that public service really is responding to those emails and responding to those local issues. And when you can get, and you know, you've seen this, I'm sure, but when you're dealing with issues that sometimes take 2, 3, 4 years to get resolved or to get dealt with, it's really rewarding and satisfying as an elected official to actually take something on that might be super hyper local and get it fixed, because then you see that you're actually accomplishing something. So it's nice to have that balance. But I agree with you in terms of the bulk email stuff. The materials that come into my inbox, when they're personally written or they're tailored specifically for me, they will definitely get more of my attention just because I know it's written to me and I have to give it more of a response.
And again, I guess the takeaway there is that the emails do get read,
yes.
Although sometimes it takes longer to respond to them. I know that there are a lot of time spent in the community engaging with different types of groups. What have you found? And I know New Westminster and Vancouver certainly are, in terms of size and scope, are probably different, but I find that I spend quite a bit of my time outside of usual kind of 9 to 5 engaging in community. There's a lot of gatherings on weekends that happen. So, but again, it's something that I've really enjoyed to try and meet and build strong working relationships with so many diverse groups in our city. What's been some of your experience in terms of engagement in the community?
Well, it's nowhere near the pace that you have. I have followed your LinkedIn pages and I have followed you on social media, and I can assure you, you definitely attend a lot more of those community events than, say, we would have in the city at the size of New Westminster. We're only 80,000 people, so there are only kind of so many community events that are out there, but we do get invited to a number of them. And obviously, you do have a lot of evening and kind of weekend activities that you participate in. I will say I'm surprised, perhaps because I was more familiar with the Vancouver context in which you are involved in, and I was aware of the volume that of invites. We just don't get, we're a small city within a big metro area, so we just don't get as many invites and activities, but there still is a fair share. Like, you still have to attend a lot of the Rotary clubs and a lot of the fundraisers and the dinners and the community events and stuff. There's still a fair amount of those, even in a city the size of New West.
So I guess the takeaway is that we're both sort of, we've jumped in on both feet on in our new roles as city councillors. I guess what I'd be interested now is maybe going through some of the big topics, the issues that are coming up everywhere from sort of hyper-local within our communities to those that are impacting local government in the region and even provincially, because we've got the Union of BC Municipalities event coming up in September, so we can do a little bit of preview on that one. So maybe let's talk city finances. Mm-hmm. We're coming into budget season. All local governments are usually trying to finalize their budgets by the end of the calendar year to for final approval into the new year. What kind of financial pressures is the city of New Westminster facing right now?
Well, our financial pressures are probably not very much dissimilar to what you're facing in Vancouver, other than just the scale. So for us, it really comes down to growth. The fact that our city is growing, more people are moving into New Westminster every single month. We are looking at lack of libraries, lack of community centers, what I've referred to during the campaign as the infrastructure deficit. I hear that term coming up a lot more now. We're talking about that. So how do we as a city When we look at the numbers that the federal government's coming out with in terms of immigration, in terms of new people moving into places like the Metro Vancouver area, how do we do it? And I stay awake at night sometimes thinking, like, are we going to have enough community and public infrastructure to actually make sure that when we're all living in this dense neighborhood, that it all works? And I think from a financial perspective, Mike, that is the one thing that costs a lot of money. Public libraries, community centers, skating rinks are not inexpensive pieces of infrastructure to build. And cities are limited in terms of the revenue that they've got. So that, from my perspective, that's a big financial pressure. Secondly, that's more on the capital side. On the operating side, clearly it comes down to kind of our human resources. We know that it's expensive to hire lots of staff, and you need staff to run programs. It's absolutely necessary. But when you look at the operating costs and the capital costs combined, it's a big financial pressure for cities the size of New West or Vancouver.
This is a topic that has just been perhaps the most eye-opening to me, is around how cities pay for things. Certainly property tax is a big part of it. When we did our first look at the city finances last year, because we decided early on as a council, and so I'm talking about the city of Vancouver, the ABC, seven councillors, and Mayor Sim, of course, that form kind of eight members of an 11-member council. We as a council decided to push off the approval. Essentially, we did not want to be approving a budget that had been done by the previous council and just rubber stamp it in December, mere weeks after being sworn in. So a decision was made that we wanted to take more time with it, which meant that we needed to try and dig into a massive, almost $2 billion budget and try to figure it out. And where were the areas that we could actually either change? And I know that the thing that first sort of caught my attention was the fact that there had been so many deep cuts in just areas of what we sort of sometimes call core services. So boulevards, gardens in the street areas, street litter, just generally kind of upkeep and making sure the street thing, the things that make people kind of like their city, is that general appearance. And some people think that it's not a huge priority when we've got such big things that are going on, but I feel it's really important that people feel good about themselves in their city. And if you're trying to create a more pedestrian culture, as we try and shift away from car trips and get more people to take public transit, walking through places that are not well tended and are full of litter and things like that is really unappealing. It makes you feel less safe, especially for vulnerable and elderly populations. Mm-hmm. And so I found out that it was probably during the Vision Council about 2012, 2013, they said, hey, our streets look great. We're going to cut that budget by 25%. Mm-hmm. And so now fast forward to what that looks like today. I said, we need to put that money back in. And I said, how much is it going to be? And it turned out to be about $600,000. Mm. In order to get it back to kind of full budget for that department to be able to stay on top of boulevards, stay on top of, you know, kind of general upkeep and cleaning in the city. So we added that. And of course, there were a number of things like that where there had been big cuts that we felt had to be prioritized. And we said, this has to be kind of a one-time kind of increase that we kind of re-level and kind of level up those budgets. And then that was it. And so that decision was made, hence a really kind of take your breath away tax increase in the city of Vancouver. We knew that that couldn't continue. And so that's why we've established a mayor's task force on the budget that will be presenting its recommendations in the coming months, obviously in time for budget decision-making time. I haven't seen what the committee has done yet, but I expect to get a briefing in the coming week. So hopefully we can take good sound advice from these individuals that bring a huge amount of experience in the area of finance and budgeting, and can find ways that we can still run the city extremely well, but sort of optimize some of that spending.
Yeah, and I think that type of innovation in terms of getting feedback and getting consultation from experts is really good. I mean, traditionally cities have consulted, but I think what the city of Vancouver is doing there is going to be an interesting experiment to see what you get back in terms of the recommendations. And obviously the real challenges will be around, you know, if there are recommendations on things to cut back or things to reduce expenditures on, there'll likely will be some debate on that. I'm sure you're anticipating that in the city of Vancouver. You know, from our perspective in the city of New Westminster, we don't have that type of a feedback, but we have been consulting with the public through our budget process. We just got a report back to council not long ago, actually at the end of summer, at the end of August. And that did talk about the public's priorities. And I must say, I was so pleasantly surprised to see that the priorities that the public had put into the feedback was things like sidewalks and things like making sure that roads are properly paved and things that you're talking about. Core services kept coming through time and time again from the public, that that's what they wanted city council to really focus on. So I'll be pleased to see the final report coming in from the public, but I agree with you, Mike. You let your city go and you don't take care of the small things, and suddenly they become bigger issues.
You mentioned infrastructure. I know that's just a whole big area, but yeah, community centers. There's a lot of strong appeal for seniors focused buildings and infrastructure. For an aging community, that's one of the first things that that I got passed unanimously. I think it was in December of last year. We got asked staff to come back with a report on sort of upping our game in terms of age-friendly city. And I know that this is an area that both of us have close to our heart, having worked together in the seniors care sector and watching that population and their needs and their requirements out that cities can provide being needed. I want to just maybe kind of shift gears a little bit here. There's again a lot of big topics to talk about. Maybe let's talk about the really big one to start off, housing. So what are you planning, and what's the city of New Westminster doing well and sort of planning to how to address the housing crisis? And of course, you mentioned immigration levels. It's forecasted that about 80,000 people just last year, because I think we're up to, actually it'll be this year or the year after, that we're up to 500,000 new immigrants. They figure that probably on the order of 20% of those will probably wind up in Metro Vancouver. So, you know, divided up. So that means, you know, tens of thousands in some larger cities and fewer, but still all of those folks and those families are going to require housing. So let's talk a little bit about what US is doing in housing.
Yeah, we certainly can. And I'll just perhaps start at the big picture is we all agree that we need more immigration. We know that you and I both have talked about this over the past decade, just around the important need to bring people into the country to keep the economy going and making sure we have the workforce in the future.
Yeah.
So take that off the table in terms of an issue. But we also know if we're going to bring in those numbers of people, that housing is going to become a very critical issue. Before the approval of those immigrants came into the country, we were already in a housing shortage. We just did not have enough rental housing, and we don't have enough housing in general. So a city like New Westminster, incredibly, I believe it's the second most dense city in all of Canada. I think it follows after Vancouver. So we have a lot of similarities. We are a very compact city. We are bordered by the river, and geographically, we don't have a lot of space, so we have to build up. So some of the pressures we're facing is just, we've run out of land. We're built out kind of like Vancouver. It's just Vancouver has nowhere else to go anymore too. It has to go up. And where do you put that housing? And how do you make sure that when you're putting in that housing, that it's affordable? And the, you know, when I look at how the city of New Westminster is looking at in terms of future development, the big conundrum and the big challenge we're going to face is we're putting a lot of requests onto these new projects, like things that, you know, I'm hearing, you know, we want to have a new fire hall, we want this, we want a school, a daycare. A lot gets compounded and added into any particular housing project. And you know, Mike, as well as I do, those costs just get passed along through eventually to the end user, the person who's going to live or rent in those spots. And that's where I'm struggling, is we need all these community amenities, we need all these things. And the only way to kind of help fund it is to pack on the cost onto the development. But if you're doing that, you're going to end up just increasing the cost of rent. And I know in the city of Vancouver, I think it's now, what, $3,000 on average for a one bedroom?
Yeah.
And New Westminster is not that far behind. So the big challenge to us, I think, as cities, and in particular in a small city like New West, is how do we identify how we're building and where we're building? And we only have, like I said, so much room left. And it's unfortunately, or fortunately, we're going to have to go up like the city of Vancouver is. And that'll be a challenge. There's a lot of people who live in small single family home neighborhoods who really love them. I used to live in one in Queen's Park, and they're beautiful. But that land is increasingly becoming a precious commodity. And so how do we, in the next 10 years, build out our city, accommodate that growth, accommodate that future workforce in homes that are affordable, that people can actually live in, and doing it within the construct of our current housing bylaws and stuff? It's going to be a challenge.
So housing, obviously, the biggest topic. I think it's the one of the great issues of our time right now. I think that the consensus is broadly there that we need more supply. There are still doubters on that one, but I think the numbers speak for themselves. In the city of Vancouver, one of the first things that we identified, and I think people were sort of critical, is that, you know, why are you focusing on just permit times? But the fact is that the time to get something moving through the rezoning and or approval process was taking far too long. And this was really a bit of calcified approach that kind of built
time
up
is money.
It built up time over time, right? And so I think what we really needed to do is to focus on that, on getting that time much more narrow, because of the cost of finance that increases, the holding costs. All of these things have the net result of increasing the cost of housing or rent for people, for the end users. And that's something that we needed to kind of push as hard as possible. Mm-hmm. So that has been kind of woven into the culture. We have something we call 3331, which was a campaign platform promise, which is 3 days for kind of a basic building permit, three weeks for like a detached housing. We have sort of less detached housing now, but like for smaller buildings, 3 months for like a mid-rise, and then 1 year for a larger development. So those numbers are certainly the ones that we are aspiring to. We're not there yet, but we are seeing some really fantastic changes brought forward by our permitting team. They have got a new digital platform that is now being piloted for, I think it's just about to come out for laneway homes. So hopefully that'll be like you go in, enter your information, it'll give you either an automatic response to move ahead and give you the permit to begin building, or it will flag the two or three issues that perhaps are holding you up that allow you to go back very quickly, respond, and then make those fixes and then reapply right away. So those are, I think, innovations that have come from this agenda of trying to decrease the amount of time. But also there are a number of areas in the city that we talk about sort of the lack of availability of land. So, you know, we've got certainly communities that we're going to be hearing from in terms of, like, we've already heard some response to a really bold proposal for the Jericho lands, a density that would completely change that area that is being developed in cooperation from the three local nations. MST is the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish. And then we've got, you know, sites that have been sort of sitting there for a long time, the Broadway and Commercial Safeway site, which is at the hub of one of the busiest transit connections in North America. And so it demands that we are able to put housing there to try and kind of match that. But I'm quite enthusiastic because I think this council that I'm a part of is going to be responding and really putting forward, I think, a number of really strong initiatives in the coming months, because we know this is the issue of our time. It's the issue provincially. It's the issue federally. And I think that as a local government, the ones that are really on the ground making some of these developments, giving them approvals and working closely with the development sector, that's our responsibility to respond to that and get that housing built.
You know, one thing I can just add before we switch off to the next topic is just around what I've been fascinated to watch and to listen, the provincial government, the federal government's involvement in all of this, given that they don't have direct responsibility, obviously, on zoning and zoning approvals, et cetera. But what I'm hearing from the province is a lot of talk around the carrot stick approach and trying to provide cities that, like Vancouver and New Westminster, who are densifying at a much faster rate than, say, other cities, being able to unlock some infrastructure dollars. And I'm very excited about that. But as they say, it's always like, you know, where the rubber meets the road. Let's see what is actually coming out from that. But I am excited if the province, from a public policy perspective, says cities that are taking on that extra densification are going to be able to access money for community centers, parks, public libraries. I'm all for it. I'm also quite intrigued as well by even federal leader Pierre Poilievre is talking about almost the same thing that the provincial NDP are talking about. So it's almost like a nonpartisan issue. They're both talking about unlocking federal dollars and provincial dollars, giving them to cities that aren't expanding their housing. So I think that if those levels of government, orders of government actually do what they say they're going to do, or if those leaders end up, for example, if Pierre Poilievre does at some point become the prime minister, and if you were to implement that along with the provincial program here in BC, boy, that would be fascinating to me, as a, especially positioned in a place like New Westminster or Vancouver, where we both know that we would be able to unlock and access a lot of those infrastructure dollars. Because I think, Mike, it's so critically important, and you've heard me talk about this, we both talked about this. If people are going to live in very dense neighborhoods, the quid pro quo is we'll live in a dense neighborhood, but boy, we better get good public amenities along with it. And you cannot just keep building towers and housing without that public amenity. And if you do not do it, we're going to lose the public's confidence and they're not going to support the increased growth.
100% agree with that. I know that as we start to unpack things in some of these densifying neighborhoods, I'm thinking about the Broadway area. We, and it came with some controversy, but we voted as a council to support staff's direction, which was to expand sidewalks, make the tree canopy better, make the livability on the street for the Broadway corridor with its, you know, I guess it'll have four new SkyTrain stations opening in 2026, Main, Canby, Oak, Granville, and O5. So in Arbutus as well, as sort of the terminus before hopefully someday going out to UBC. But that means that we need to try and really build around those areas, those SkyTrain stations. And you've got two of them in your own city, I think.
Five.
Oh my gosh. So and so that's again another area that we're having really serious discussions around, because we built SkyTrain stations in East Vancouver at 29th Avenue and Nanaimo Street that don't have any responding densification that's happening. So again, there's a lot of discussion around that. I know there's been some land assemblies, there's a lot of work, but the fact is that the city right now is the one that's potentially holding that up. So that's something that I think one of the areas that we'll need to change.
Yeah, and we do have, for example, I often will cite Nanaimo SkyTrain Station and the 22nd Street SkyTrain Station in New Westminster is very similar. All low density, single family homes around it, yet an amazing amount of public infrastructure in those SkyTrain stations. I know that in New Westminster, we're now undertaking a review, a kind of a complete rethink of that 22nd Street SkyTrain Station area, the Connaught Heights area. And there's likely going to be a lot more densification going into those areas. But it's hard to imagine, Mike, that that SkyTrain Station in Nanaimo and 22nd Street was built in 1986 during Expo. And we're still, you and I, talking about a very low density neighborhood with the ability for people to be very close to transit. So yeah, we've made a lot of progress around some SkyTrain stations, definitely, but there's still work to go on a few more.
Well, all right. So I'd like to maybe shift gears away from housing. Again, it's a huge topic. We'd spend an entire hour talking about it at least. What are the, you know, maybe let's tiptoe through a few different other challenges that the cities are facing. Certainly public safety was, I think, a real central part of the 2022 election campaign. And it was something that we spoke about a lot, and it's something that we've been trying to respond to, again, through making sure that we support our police, properly fund it, bring in mental health nurses. These are some of the initiatives we brought forward. And but also just being generally responsive to some of the disorder and the property crime that is resulting in some of our communities. Some of these things are huge challenges right now. But what are you seeing and feeling and hoping for in the city of New Westminster when it comes to public safety?
I will say, Mike, that is the one area that I have probably had the most public response on any topic, perhaps just slightly below housing. But the crime and safety and public disorder in the city of New Westminster is at a level that I can't go to the Safeway or to the grocery store or community event and people talk about it with me. They talk about the fact that the children's parks are littered with needles and drug paraphernalia. They talk about the fact that, you know, over the last few months, we've had open air shootings in our downtown. people pulling out guns and starting to fire at the, you know, people walking by. I mean, the list goes on of issues around public disorder. And it strikes me that, again, going back to our previous topic around densification and, you know, having more people live in a very small urban area, if we don't get control of this, if we don't make sure that when it goes dark, and if you're a senior citizen and you want to walk on Columbia Street downtown or on Main Street in Vancouver, you should feel safe. You should not feel uncomfortable walking outside. And unfortunately, Mike, way too many seniors, in particular seniors who have approached me, have said, I don't go out anymore. I've had a lot of women who've also talked to me who live downtown in New Westminster, said, not doing it. I'm not walking on Columbia. And if we get to the point where both of our communities, people are staying at home, they're not going outside, they're worried about public safety, we will have lost so much in terms of building vibrant, commercially active and supportive communities. And I am very worried about that.
I've been responding to somebody who emailed me in early August and promised them that I would sort of follow up, meet with the VPD to try and figure out. But there, he actually sent me all of the police reports that he had done. But what was really sad about it is that, you know, he was bringing his kids out and they were witnessing, you know, some violence, threats to people. I guess this fellow's spouse had also been threatened at one point. And I just felt like, you know, this person is trying to raise a family, you know, be a good member of their community, yet they go outside and then they are facing it. So this is not happening in all parts of our city. Of course, some neighborhoods are struggling a little bit more than others, but I think at the very least, people have to feel, they have to feel safe in their community. And we have to make sure that that we are working with agencies. So I'll use the example of the Yale Town OPS overdose prevention site that was there, that has been cause of such concern. We learned, and this was not a decision that council made, but we've learned that the lease for that property is not being renewed, and therefore in the new year that space will be closing. But it can't come soon enough for the community. I was on the Mike Smith show to talk about this, and I said, these types of facilities can be run properly and are run properly in other communities, but we cannot allow it to spill it onto the street. So we have to have operators that are going to continue to hold the importance of that that community safety piece, making sure that there isn't drug paraphernalia being left around. You know, there were really violent things. There were people live around there. It's a very dense neighborhood in Yale Town. So we got lots of people on social media posting pictures. And one was somebody fighting with a machete. And I said, look, if you're at the level where you're fighting with machetes out openly on the street, that's usually a signal to you that something profoundly needs to change. So now it's really up to Vancouver Coastal Health to decide where they would like to provide those services, and they can work with the city, and we have a decision to make forthcoming on that one. And this is not to say that we're going to abandon people that are sick and need that help, but the fact is that when you have that interface between a neighborhood that just wants to be able to, you know, kind of go outside, do a shopping, go to a park, and not have to be looking over their shoulder constantly, versus people who are in need of medical and mental health services.
Yeah, and I think that's an important topic, and you raised it there, just around like who is walking on our streets, and yes, there are criminals, there are people who steal and rob and do that kind of stuff. But there are also so many people that I know would and do require mental health supports. And what are we doing in our community in terms of making sure that we're all advocating at least the civic level to the upper orders of government to invest more in mental health beds, and making sure that there are significantly more mental health beds available here in our community, not just in New West and Vancouver, but across the province? I just don't feel like we're making enough progress on that front. I also think that, you know, when you look at just like basic housing, like basic actual access to social housing and affordable housing, these are all, and then also treatment beds as well. I should mention that as well. So when you have a lack of addiction treatment beds, you have a lack of mental health beds and a lack of housing, that is a perfect storm to trigger a lot of public disorder. And I can't put my finger on it. I know people are looking at it and researching it, but post-COVID, our cities aren't the same. It's just not. I walk around, it does not feel the same. And but part of it is when I look at these individuals, and they are all individuals, I don't put any blanket, each person has a different story. But I can't help but think that so many of them require mental health supports, or they require drug addiction treatment, and they're not getting access to it. And until we do that, Mike, you and I will be talking about this topic for probably the next 100 podcasts. There needs to be a significant new investments to making sure that people who have issues with their own mental health have access to those services.
Well said. I don't disagree with you. We've got to really have other levels of government work very strongly together with our municipalities to try and address that. Because as you said, when you traveled across the country this summer, you saw this problem on different sort of scale in almost every small town that you crossed between here and Ontario when you were on a road trip with your family. And so I've been repeating that to people, that this is not something that's just local to Vancouver. It's happening in multiple small and medium-sized towns right across the country as well.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And the reason I spoke out about that in council, about I just for everyone's benefit, I traveled 6,500 kilometers. I went through all of the northern US and then came back to Canada. And what struck me was how, whether I was in a small town like Kalispell, Montana, or I was in Williston, North Dakota, or I was in Regina or Calgary, there was a common thread. And the common thread was that they were all struggling with homelessness. They were all struggling with people who required mental health supports who were on the streets. And they were all struggling with people who have drug addiction who do not have access to recovery beds and for treatment. And that's not just a Vancouver thing. It is very acute in Vancouver. It is absolutely acute in the downtown east side, but it's not unique to Vancouver. So something's happening in our society, and we need to rethink perhaps the investments that we're making in these types of supports. And if we don't do that, like I said, we're going to be having this discussion in your podcast a decade from now.
So lots of big topics to talk about with the local government, but I want to maybe kind of zero in on a few different areas that as we continue to indulge our listeners' time and have them hear kind of a live conversation about our experience in local government. Maybe we'll just sort of throw it out there. What are some of the biggest surprises that you faced in your 10 months as a city councillor?
Mm-hmm. Well, not a ton of surprises. I mean, a lot of it, I think I kind of expected. You know, people have asked me that and they're like, do you have any big surprises? And I say probably the big surprises that I haven't had that many big surprises. I actually expected a lot of what I expected. I guess for me, the big surprise is I would have hoped that things would have been able to move faster. Like when you get a motion at council, and perhaps even when it's not just a majority, but it's a supermajority, everyone agrees on council, we're going down this road. Just how long and complicated it can be to get things done. And I think that I have to kind of, and I've had to, you know, temper my expectations around being able to make things happen super quick, that these things often take, as I say, you're measuring these things in inches, not in feet sometimes in terms of progress. And that for me is probably the biggest surprise, that even with unanimous support, that things can often take way longer to get accomplished than you thought.
I'm kind of in the same boat. Both you and I have experience around and been following and writing about local government for a long time. So when we came into the actual job and became a representative of the public, there was not something that was utterly shocking, but I think there are many pleasant surprises for me. And I have to say, in my role as a city councillor, I realize that I have a very important responsibility in representing the public, in working and supporting our teams out there. So whether it is somebody, working out, cleaning up one of our streets, or whether it's one of our cultural management teams or some of our leadership, it's important that we're always there to try and support people. And when I have been kind of excited about is that there is a real openness for reviewing and kind of rethinking some policy and maybe advancing it. I know that Arts and culture, for example, is a real passion of mine, having worked in and around many parts of our arts and culture sector. And I include the movie industry, video game industry, some of live theater. I've been involved in a number of festivals in the time. And of course, I was a director and the president of the Pell Vancouver Board, which is really about housing for people in the arts and arts and culture sector. But I really want to, I think people are really ready for us to continue to make Vancouver a much more vibrant place. And we can do that through looking at our public art program and seeing if there's ways that we can pool some of those funds and make some really exciting placemaking public art happen. Speaking of placemaking, I've been really pleasantly surprised at how excited people are about rethinking the Granville Street and the Granville Mall area. We have a whole kind of public engagement process that will involve both kind of Indigenous lens on how we can try revitalize that street, but also just thinking about that music and entertainment culture that that the Granville Street area is known for. We've put obviously a lot of emphasis on places like Chinatown. So we've now got a new office that is opening very soon. We had kind of an official office opening, but the operational side of the office will start taking place more in September. Councillors are going to be down there in Chinatown, being able to do more engagement with those parts of the city as well. Places like Gastown, for example, just last weekend, they had the Meet Me in Gastown Festival, which was just amazing to see that whole area, the street closed off, thousands of people down there, live music, the patios were filled, people were enjoying entertainment on the street. And so it was a real picture of how we can have and retake some of those communities and make them exciting and vibrant. So those are kind of areas that I love spending some time on, that because, you know, when you're not dealing with some of the enormous amount of council reading and other community engagements, you have actual time to sit down and think about where you want to go in this role in terms of influencing the future of the city. I want to talk a little bit about local news. And the reason being is that, you know, we've seen this huge shift in the landscape. Certainly some of the federal legislation that has led to local news outlets not being able to be featured onto some social media platforms. And just generally, you know, gone are the days, it seems, when you had a lot of people covering local government stories right across the province. Vancouver still has a lot of the lion's share of the attention, but what are you sort of hearing and seeing when it comes to telling the story of what's happening in our local governments and media?
Well, I can tell you that we've had some fairly significant changes in the local landscape in a place like New Westminster, and I believe also in Burnaby, Coquitlam, other smaller cities, in that you and I have witnessed this over the past probably 20 years. Just unfortunately, the landscape on media is just changing, and we lost our print edition of our newspaper, the Record newspaper, over the summer. So the publisher announced that three communities, and New Westminster was one of them, would be losing our print edition. Now, Mike, you might say, oh, well, you know, do you really need print paper anymore? You know, we're all digital. But for a lot of seniors and for a lot of people who aren't perhaps as tech savvy, that newspaper meant a lot. And I can't tell you how many times when I knocked on the doors, people had that paper there. They were showing me articles from the paper. They were reading it. They were really connected to the community. I am very concerned as we move now to no more print edition. And then now further to that, Bill C-18 coming in and Facebook restricting our local newspaper from being even seen on the social media platforms. Where are people going to get their information? How are we going to communicate as a community when we've lost a lot of that over the fence discussion that we used to have? And we were relying on papers and our local newspaper to do that. So I don't know where it's all going to go, but I know that I'm sufficiently concerned, and I hope that we can find new mediums and new ways to have that communication, because understanding what's going on at local government is so critical. Like it's just, It's where the rubber meets the road. The decisions you and I are making at city councils impact people every single day. And I'm not saying that the federal and provincial government don't, but they simply don't. Like a lot of the stuff that we do, it just does. It impacts this residents. And if there's no way for people to know that things are coming or be able to provide feedback, I'm not sure if it's going to help in the development of good public policy moving forward. So, but I know it's not going to change. I know the print papers are done. Like I don't see them coming back. But what does the future hold? I don't know.
Well, I know that that there have been some really great reporting. Is it Teresa McManus? Yes. For the New Westminster Record, just a fantastic, dedicated City Hall reporter. And you know, we had some of these upstart kind of email-driven things, like the Burnaby Beacon, and some of those things were positive. They came directly to your inbox, but it still feels like it's falling a little bit short. And yeah, of course, maybe we're just signaling how old we are, that we still would like to have that print edition be able to come in, but it got thinner and thinner over time. And I totally appreciate that the business model is definitely very different right now. I think it does provide an opportunity. Now certainly social media has got its strengths and its challenges. And the challenges are that it too often becomes an environment where, you know, I've really learned the term rage farming, where people are getting really upset about a particular issue, and it kind of takes gets way out of proportion without much real understanding of the basis of the issue. People are easily sort of spurned to kind of react to these things without actually understanding, you know, what the end goal is in terms of a policy decision and what have you. But I do think it does provide other opportunities, and we are seeing, you know, the growth of things like podcasts. Hence, me sort of tearing the wraps off of the Vancouver Overcast podcast for the first time in over a year. But Daniel, I think you probably are talking about yourself developing a brand new podcast. Maybe you can give us a little preview of what you have in mind.
Sure, Mike. You and I, as you know, only too well, used to blog quite a bit a while ago, and that blog kind of faded away as, you know, our lives got busy and we didn't have as much time to blog. And then you did do your podcast, which was very inspirational, and I've been on it, which is great. But, you know, I've had a lot of people in the community say to me that with the Record newspaper, kind of the print edition being gone and the lack of access to you know, elected officials and what's going on, a lot of people encourage me to do a podcast. So I still have my website, my blog, which was out there. So I announced a few weeks ago that my blogging days were gone. I was not, as much as I love sitting in front of the laptop and writing, I just noticed that the total number of people clicking and reading longer pieces just is going down. But a lot of folks said to me, like myself, I listen to a lot of podcasts now. So my listening and where I get my information has really been changing. So I made the decision to have my own podcast. So I'm going to be launching it this fall. It's the first, I've never told anyone, so this is the first time breaking news. It's going to be called For the Record with Daniel Fontaine. And I hope to cover not only New Westminster politics, local politics, what's happening in our community, but also perhaps bring in some guests every so often. I'd love to maybe have you on the podcast at some stage and others. And let's talk about municipal politics, not only from the context of New West, but maybe from the context of our entire region. So really excited to get it going this fall. It's going to be a bit of work, so I have a little bit of homework, and I'm thanks to you and others who've given me some great tips on looking up some YouTube videos and getting some research done. I'm in the throes of all of that right now, and I don't have the exact date on when I'll launch it, but it'll be very soon.
Absolutely looking forward to For the Record with Daniel Fontaine. You heard it here, folks, on the Vancouver Overcast podcast. Daniel, I know that I'm looking forward to that very much. I know that not only is your passion for local government, I know that you're also doing an enormous amount of consulting work right now. You're working still in the sort of support the health sector, working with agencies that working closely with companies that provide long-term care and other services for seniors. Are there any other kind of things that, you know, you have going on right now that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, well, I'm very much consulting. So that's something that I started up about a year and a half ago, and it's been going real gangbusters, which is awesome. As a consultant, you want to be busy, and I'm definitely very busy. And I'm hoping that the podcast is, in addition to municipal, I might actually look at doing some stuff in terms of my work, like some of the areas that I'm doing in terms of healthcare and management consulting, strategic planning. So I might even delve into that a little bit more. But on a personal front, I'm very much still active in hockey and still very much supporting the tournaments. And I actually, Mike, got to announce my first Salmon Bellies game. So I got invited to a local Salmon Bellies tournament, and they asked me to do the announcing for that, which was awesome. I was very nervous, I must admit, because I wasn't sure if all the hand signals for the penalties were the same, etc. But it worked out really, really well. Enjoyed that. So very much still active in the community and enjoying, when I have that time for some volunteer hours, which unfortunately is so limited these days, but I'm out in the community doing as much as I can.
Okay. Well, let's kind of bring it home let's bring the podcast home and kind of wrap things up. We're now kind of getting close to almost an hour. Let's talk a little bit about what we're sort of seeing in the coming weeks. And I wanted to just mention it before, but the UBCM is having their conference in the third week of September. You're going to be there. I'm going to be there. What are you expecting and hope to accomplish by engaging with some of your fellow local government officials from around the province?
Well, for our listeners who don't know what UBCM is or what it stands for, it's the Union of British Columbia Municipalities Convention. So every single municipal leader in the province of British Columbia comes down to typically Vancouver, Victoria. So we're all gathering in a few weeks. And there's a number of resolutions that are coming forward, and they cover the full range of everything. And you can imagine, with so many municipal governments and municipal politicians in the province, there are some interesting, quirky issues that come to the table, as well as some very heavy ones like housing and crime and safety, etc. So I'm expecting this is the first UBCM since the election last fall. So there are a number of new representatives like yourself and myself, that this will be their first opportunity to come in and to debate. So what am I expecting? I'm expecting that the issue of housing will be very big. I'm expecting a lot of the stuff we talked about in this podcast, transportation, crime and safety, investments, in particular around the increasing role that the federal and provincial governments are having in the municipal side. It seems like, as I look into my crystal ball into the future, I can't help but see how the federal and provincial governments are going to be, I hate to use the word interfering, but are going to be involved much more into the day-to-day lives of municipalities in a way that we have never seen, I would say, in the past decade or two. So how will that manifest? How will that work itself out? UBCM is a good, you and I will probably be hearing from a number of the provincial cabinet ministers are there. I believe some of the federal folks might be there as well. We're going to hear in the hallways and at the water coolers what people are thinking and what people are saying about that. But I have a feeling that's going to be very topical.
Yeah, I know that the City of Vancouver is going to have a strong contingent there. All of our council will be there. And I am looking forward to some of the keynote speeches from all the different party leaders provincially. And also, I know that climate is going to be one of the big areas, that there's some motions that are coming from the City of Vancouver that we're going to be looking for support for as well. But I think it'll really be interesting. I'm really excited. I mean, I've had a chance through Metro Vancouver, through the Lower Mainland Local Government Association to build some new friendships and new connections throughout the region. But I'm also really looking forward to connecting with some of those mayors and town councillors and regional district representatives right across the province here, because I think we have a lot of common cause, a lot of things that we could be doing together in terms of advocating to senior levels of government, which is a big part of what the UBCM is about.
Yeah, and I think that what I'll be watching for is as you know, at UBCM, typically the premier always comes in and there's always some kind of an announcement. There's always something that comes out of that. So obviously, Premier Eby's address to the UBCM will be one of interest to everyone as well. We have a provincial election coming perhaps sooner than we think, who knows, but definitely within the next year or so. And I would anticipate that the leader of the opposition, Kevin Falcon, with the BC United, will also be addressing the crowd. And he might have some things that he's going to want to say in terms of what he'd like to do with his municipal partners. So I always, like you, I always love hearing those speeches, because there's so much embedded in those 20 or 30 minutes that they're up on stage. And often they are newsmakers. Some things happen. And we know that already provincially, there's some legislation coming down this fall which will definitely have some impact in terms of housing and some other areas. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens.
I agree. There's going to be some interesting news probably coming from the province. And we certainly are now seeing this debate raging at the federal level as well. All topics that we can sort of stand back and look from the outside is local government officials. And if I can sort of say one thing that has also been a pleasant surprise, and not in the sense that I didn't think it would happen, but I'm really proud of the fact that in our case, the city of Vancouver has been working really closely and very strongly on resolving issues with the provincial government, especially around housing. Childcare is another area that is a big passion of mine, working with Councillor Lisa Dominato and others to make sure that we meet the commitment of our thousands of new childcare spaces in the city, because we have huge demand there. We saw the whole issue kind of blow up earlier in August regarding the permitting within a private childcare center inside of a person's home. So those are the kinds of issues that I know they're going to continue to happen. We've had a little bit of downtime, a little family time in the month of August, but we're getting ready to kind of hit the ground running in September, and really looking forward to seeing what the fall brings.
Yeah. And I just want to, just before we wrap up, just, you know, kudos to Mayor Ken Sim for, I think a lot of this happens because of the leadership that you have. It's not just things, relationships between a premier and a mayor just don't happen because they happen. They happen because you have individuals who are committed to making that happen. And both Premier Eby and Mayor Sim have definitely made a commitment to wanting to work together and have the two governments work together. So kudos to your mayor for, taking that nonpartisan, if I can say it in air quotes, nonpartisan approach, and making sure that that the doors are open and that communication is there. Because there have been cities, and I won't point fingers, but there have been some cities that have taken a very vastly different approach than Mayor Sim. And I would dare say that the relationships between the province and those cities have not, and likely will not be, as effective for at least a number of years to come. So I think that was very tactical and very smart move on the part of Mayor Sim to do what he's been doing, and to continue to make sure that, notwithstanding the fact that he may not necessarily be politically aligned with the province, but he sees the bigger picture. He understands that you have to work with the province if you're going to get things done.
100%. Yeah. Well, we're definitely seeing that happening with Ken. He's one of the things is that he always likes to have people refer to him as Ken, not your worship, not the mayor. No, it's definitely a new style that has sort of caught a lot of people's attention. And the fact that he doesn't really absorb the formalities of the office. He just likes to jump in there and engage with people. And that's something that I think all of us as a councillor are finding kind of a refreshing approach as well. So I'm going to just kind of wrap things up here at this point, Dan. I know we could talk for a lot longer on a lot of other different topics regarding to local government, but I'm really glad that I was able to bring Daniel in. I want to thank him very much for being a part of the Vancouver Overcast podcast for the third time. And I hope to be able to do more episodes in the coming weeks and months, just to try and inform you a little bit about some of the work that's happening in the community. And it won't be just strictly about what council business, but certainly about some of the leaders that we have that are doing great things in the city of Vancouver. So with that, have a great fall, and definitely be able to check in at Vancouver Overcast YVR at YouTube. And on Twitter and on Instagram, you'll be able to find content. And of course, you'll be able to get this podcast in all of your normal favorite channels, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify being two of the biggest ones. So thank you very much, Daniel. And we appreciate you coming on the cast. And we'll see you again out in UBC and UBCM.
Thanks so much, man.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.